Paul's question after recalling the Galatians ignorant, stupid, after attacking them for becoming apostates, for rejecting what Paul had preached. Asked these questions, even though he didn't know how to phrase the question in Greek. This is Galatians 1:10. For currently, men, I persuade, or the God, or I seek to please men. Yet, nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating, slave of Christu, certainly not was me. Now, there's no way to overemphasize the consequence of this question, should it be a question. No matter the answer, it proves that Paul did not speak for God. It also demonstrates that his use of we did not include God in his previous statements. Whether he's trying to persuade men, to win the favor of men, to seduce men, to mislead men, to coax, convince, and placate men, or he was trying to do those things to God, both are bad. One shows a level of ego that is beyond control. The other shows the heart and soul of a con man. There is no answer to this question that isn't horrible for Christians. But it doesn't get better from here. After posing a question where both options have horrendous ramifications, indeed sinister religious implications, Shaul spins his question, posing it a different way, and yet we ought not try to accommodate or please men. Yahweh doesn't. Look at Yahusha. He didn't either. Never. In fact, God's approach is just the opposite. He is resolutely intolerant. He does not accommodate the views of people. He opposes them. And he is displeased with humanity. While it is Yahweh's desire for us to get to know him, he only accommodates the few who do. Also problematic. With the juxtaposition of the first and second E, which is or in Greek, we cannot isolate Paul seeking to please men from the possibility that he is attempting to accommodate God. The first option is disingenuous and pathetic, and the second is ludicrous. Not only were these questions left unanswered, which leaves one wondering why they were posed in the first place, they were followed by eti, nevertheless, and e, if, strongly suggesting that Paul actually wanted us to think that he was capable of sparring with God, of going mano a gato, of arm wrestling God for who's right. Matching wits with the creator of the universe, Paul the God. Further, aresco, the verb that Paul deploys next, isn't a cerebral concept, but instead speaks of exciting and enticing emotions. And the object this time is Christu, indicating that God, rather than being predictable and dependable, can be swayed by an emotional appeal. So while Yahusha has an emotional component to his nature, everything we know about God affirms that he values an informed and rational response over misdirected feelings. It should go without saying. But because Paul routinely infers that he died to become Christ, which is what of Christo certainly not was me conveys, to the degree that this is thought to be the Messiah Yahusha, nothing could be further from the truth. However, if one sees Paul's Iesu Christu as the new and mythological caricature upon which Pauline Christianity was contrived, then the author of this letter is the living embodiment of the Christian Jesus Christ. The Christian Jesus Christ is Paul. Paul never cites, never once quotes Yahusha. Never once. He never once speaks of the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua by Yahusha, which is the principal mission of his existence. He never talks about the connection between Yahweh and Yahusha. Never states that Yahusha is the living incarnate word of Yahweh. Creates a caricature that is modeled entirely on himself. He doesn't just speak for him. He is him. That's powerful, folks. The mythological caricature upon which Pauline Christianity was contrived is modeled after Paul. It is Paul's alter ego, Jesus Christ. The Christian Jesus Christ is Paul. Paul is to Jesus Christ as Muhammad is to Allah. I want you to think about that for a moment. Allah was a pagan rock god. He was the embodiment of the black stone in the Kaaba, of which there were 360-some-odd fellow rock gods and goddesses. He was just one of a bunch of mineral deities. And Muhammad spoke for him. He took an individual, if you want to call a rock an individual, and gave it supreme status. He spoke for him. Everything that is known about Allah is communicated by Muhammad. Every thought Allah ever had, every deed Allah ever claims to perpetrating, everything that is known about the Islamic Allah comes from the mouth of Muhammad. And come to find out, Allah was modeled after Muhammad. There is no distinguishing characteristic between Allah and Muhammad. They're one and the same. Not only does Muhammad speak for Allah, Muhammad is Allah. The same thing is true in Christianity. Paul didn't just speak for his creation of Jesus Christ. He is the Christian Jesus Christ. They're one and the same. The only thing that's different here is that rather than elevating a mineral rock, a material rock, to the alter ego of the prophet, in the case of Muhammad, he corrupted a individual that was essentially unknown to his audience. He took one man, completely disassociated him from his name and from his deeds, as well as from his words. And he turned that man into his alter ego. Therefore, the Christian Jesus Christ is Paul. It's extraordinarily sobering, but it's true. Just as Allah is Muhammad. They're one and the same. If you know one, you know the other. If you like one, you'll like the other. If we were to dispense with the dubious connections and evaluate Paul's rhetoric as if this were a debate, he'd flunk that test too. Paul deployed a non sequitur. The initial question was not answered by his hypothetical. There was no quid pro quo between accommodating man and serving his Christu. However, and moreover, How is it that Paul, who fashions himself as the one who liberated the faithful from the bondage of the Torah, is now positioning himself as a slave? And not anyone's slave. He's now in servitude to the same Christu whose death supposedly freed everyone from slavery, according to Paul. So this has become a litany of contradictions. The fact remains, only an egomaniac would suggest that someone might actually wonder whether this man was persuading God. And that is especially troublesome since the opening stanza of this letter says that Paul was effectively persuading and convincing men. Beyond this, perhaps we can deduce that Paul's intent was to convince his audience by displaying hostility toward the Galatians at large, as well as against any other message or messenger, even from heaven, that he was demonstrating, even proving, that he was out to please God and not men. But nothing displeases God more than denouncing and discarding his testimony. This is a serious problem for thinking Christians. When Paul wasn't focusing on himself, he was focused on presenting an errant characterization of Yahusha. Neither perspective has merit. Even Yahusha told us that we should focus on the Father and not him. But since Paul is opposed to Yahweh and his Torah, he won't go down that road. I'm keenly aware that there is a limit to the amount of criticism an audience will endure, particularly when the criticism is directed at the most laudable individual in a religion, Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament. And while we are called to love our enemies, we are actually encouraged to expose and condemn God's foes, which is why questioning Paul is so essential. But to be appropriate, our criticisms need to be bolstered by evidence and reason. They need to be consistent with God's testimony, and they should be focused on an individual, an institution, or on a specific message. However, in Paul's case, his blanket dismissal of the entire province and nation isn't appropriate, but to expose and condemn. Yeah, well, 666 years before Paul wrote his first letter, this letter to the Galatians, asked us why so few question him. He called him the plague of death. And so it's important for us to understand why Yahweh was so opposed to Paul, the founder of the Christian religion. But Paul has gone off and criticized the Torah, denounced the Torah. He has denounced really the entire testimony of Yahweh, choosing to replace it with his own view of things. And so, if we're going to consider God's testimony as worthy, we have to be opposed to Paul's. I mean, this letter opens similarly to the Romans 7 diatribe with a universal condemnation of what Paul referred to as the Old Testament, saying that his Jesus Christ ripped us away from that system. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It's the antithesis of the truth. But that's Pauline Christianity. It's wrong. It doesn't please God. It upsets him. There are no Christians in heaven, not one. So while it's appropriate to constructively criticize religious documents and institutions, it's not appropriate to rail against their victims en masse. And yet Paul is lashing out at everyone while undermining everyone because he suspects everyone is his foe. He's paranoid from heaven to earth, and he feels compelled to cut them all down. In this regard, his tone will evolve from condescending to vicious, becoming uncivilized. And while he never apologizes, and while it's never appropriate, since Paul posed the question, His wholly antagonistic attitude towards men reveals that the answer to the question he has posed is that he's debating God. He's certainly not trying to accommodate men. He's opposed to all men. He's debating God. As the evidence will demonstrate, Paul's rage was universally misplaced. Paul's adversaries were leading the Galatians to Yahweh, while Paul was taking them for a ride in the opposite direction. Now, apart from the errant title Christ, my concern with the most influential translations is that they were neither consistent with the actual text nor remotely accurate. They both added and I'm going to share them with you here, a plethora of words to artificially elevate the quality of the writing. So, as has been our custom, I'm going to share with you other translations, popular translations, the most popular translations of the same statement. And what you're going to find is that the difference between what Paul wrote and what they published is monumental, all with an eye to creating the impression that this was inspired by a literate individual as opposed to a dunderhead. Now, here's what Paul actually wrote. For because currently and simultaneously men I persuade, I presently, actively, and actually use words to win the favor of, seducing, misleading, coaxing, convincing, appeasing, and placating, or alternatively, the God. Or by comparison and contrast, I seek and desire to please and accommodate humans. Yet nevertheless, if men, I was pleasing and accommodating, existing the emotions, or exciting the emotions of, and lifting up a slave of Christu, certainly not was me. Out of this muddled mess, the King James Version published, for do I now persuade men or God? Or do I seek to please men? For if I yet pleased men, I should not be the servant of Christ. Wow. I mean, that's horrible. Not only is it inaccurate, the statement is reprehensible. While Christians no doubt see this as a rhetorical question, the deeper we dig into Paul's mantra and mindset, the more likely it becomes that Paul thought himself qualified to persuade God to change his plan of salvation. The Latin Vulgate reads, for am I now persuading men or God? Or am I seeking to please men? If I still were pleasing men, then I would not be a servant of Christ. We'll consider the New Living Translation for giggles in a moment. One like the King James and the Latin Vulgate, both of which just are horrible in their wording. The New Living Translation reads beautifully. It's a shame that God didn't inspire Paul to write as eloquently. Obviously, they write, I'm not trying to win the approval of people, but of God. If pleasing people were my goal, I would not be Christ's servant. Oh, beautiful spin on that, right? What you did is write a novel, of course. I mean, there's almost no correlation between what Paul wrote and what the New Living Translation published as the Word of God. But yeah, it's at least beautifully stated. It's just that there's no correlation between it and what Paul wrote. Obviously, I'm not trying to win the approval of people. There's no obviously. And there's no not trying to win. And there's no approval. And there's no but of God. The but of is not there. And there's no goal in there. And there's no pleasing there. And there's no servant there. It's just horrible. Now, while there is an extremely remote possibility that this may have been what Paul meant to say, it absolutely isn't what Paul wrote. And should they have magically captured Paul's intent, we're incapable of winning the approval of God. That is the reason God conceived a plan whereby he did all that was required to make us acceptable. Next, we find Paul professing that the message he was revealing was his own. And Paul wanted everyone the world over to recognize that the mantra, which would become known as the gospel, was hypo ego, by, under, and through me, by reason and force of me, because of and controlled by me. The gospel of Christianity is hypo ego with me, being Paul. But, therefore, I profess and reveal to you, brothers, of the beneficial messenger and healing message which has been communicated advantageously by myself, ego, because it is not in accord with man. Galatians 1:11. But, therefore, however and nevertheless, I profess and reveal, gonorzo, I reveal and tell, I provide the knowledge I've gained to make known. I recognize and declare to you, brothers, of the beneficial messenger and healing message, euangelion, translated gospel by most Christian Bibles, actually not translated, replaced by, which having been communicated advantageously by myself, ego, hypo ego, under and through, by reason and force of, because of and controlled by ego, myself, because it was not in accord with man. Yes, it wasn't in accord with God either. It was Paul's. I profess and reveal. You know, throughout the prophets, throughout the Torah, prophets and Psalms, what you constantly read is Yahweh speaking in first person. Yahweh declares his intent, his plan. Yahweh conveys his message in his own words, but not in Paul's letters. It's all about ego, me, myself, and I. I profess, I say, it's my gospel. Never, ever do you hear that from someone who is actually speaking for Yahweh. This, of course, means that Paul was solely responsible for his gospel. He conceived it all by himself, and he alone was authorized to declare it. As such, Paul is solely responsible for the mythology that became Christianity. There is no one else to credit or to blame. If his personal and individual revelations are not true, and they are not, the religion he conceived is wholly unreliable. Christian clerics universally recognize, and they readily admit, that Paul opposed Yahusha's disciples. This statement merely explains why. His message was his own, where theirs was Yahusha's. And set into the context of debating God, this is an incriminating confession. But even if you were unaware of Paul's underhanded slap at his adversaries, Yahusha's disciples, both human and divine, Yahusha himself, Yahweh, it was either egregiously presumptuous or an outrageous confession to write gnorizo. Gnorizo means I reveal and I provide in the first person. Gnorizo. the euangelion, the beneficial messenger and healing message. And I, euangelio, communicated advantageously, hypo-ego, by myself. If Paul were speaking for God, he shouldn't be touting his words. He should be touting God's testimony. Said another way, someone who is actually speaking for God knows that his message, God's message, is all that matters, not the one who delivers it. Had this been anything more than Paul claiming that claiming the world as his own, he would have done what we are doing, which is to dissect the errant message, showing through evidence and reason where it was wrong. Shaul would have delineated pertinent examples of the euangelion which differed from his own. If that's what he was doing, if he were saying, you know, they lied to you and I'm telling you the truth, he would have said, this is what they said of Yahusha. We can read it now in Matanya and Yahuchanan. This is what they said who were living with him said of Yahuchanan, but no, I've got an entirely different message. This is mine. It's not in accord with those men. It's mine. It's brought to you advantageously by me alone. Whoa. And yet this man founded the world's largest religion with this rhetoric. Never once said this is how their message differed from his own. It's obvious, differs in every possible way. The only message Paulos has condemned is God's, discrediting and discarding his Torah. The McReynolds Interlinear reveals that the Nestle Allen text reads, I make known for to you, brothers, the good message, the having been told good message by me, that not is by man. So, in order to make those words appear credible, euangelion and euangelizo had to be rendered differently, even though their etymological basis is identical. So here's the King James. But I certify to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached of me is not after man. Oh, that's incriminating. The King James Version accurately asserted that Paul certified that the gospel which was preached was of me. In a rational world, this would have been sufficient to bury him. Jerome's blend of old Latin text was both less accurate and less convicting. The Latin Vulgate reads, for I would have you understand, brothers, that the euangelium, which has been euangelizitum by me, is not according to man, but ever in form. The New Living Translation ignored 6 of the 12 Greek words, and they added 10 English words of their own choosing. Still inadequate to support their theology, they grossly misrepresented and inconsistently translated euangelion. Dear brothers and sisters, I want you to understand that the gospel message I preach is not based on mere human reasoning. Whew. Those of you who have bought a New Living Translation, you may want to take it back as defective. As I say, you know, you misrepresented this text. Take it back as defective. The use of mere implies that human reasoning was a contributing force, a contributing factor. And that suggests that Yahweh's message was incomplete and inadequate, and that he required the contribution of Paul's considerable intellect. When you combine Paul's arrogant and incriminating statements with the Christian interpretation of them, you have the crime and the confession all laid out bare and naked right at your feet. So why have so few people held Paul accountable for his crime? Accepted his confession. What follows is the other half of Shaul's, Paul's, defense. He's saying that he wasn't influenced by any human agenda or institution, while implying that those who oppose him are in opposition to God. The opposite, however, is true. Paul's approach and style are rabbinic, and it would be hard to find someone more opposed to God than Paul. Now, if only someone could have taught Paul how to write. But neither, because by man associating myself with it, nor was I taught, but to the contrary, by way of a revelation of Ayishu Christu, Galatians 1:2. Wow. Perfectly muddled and invalid. We'll be back. After telling us that the gospel is his own, that he alone is the source of the gospel that became Christianity, Paul says, but neither because I, by man, associating myself with it, nor was I taught, but to the contrary, by way of a revelation of Ayusu Christu. All right, so here's some truth. Muhammad, like Paul, was a quasi-illiterate dunderhead, the last person on earth that God would choose to reveal his message. Both were overtly egotistical, maniacal, by their own admission. Paul, just like Muhammad, encountered Satan. Satan looked like light. But both of them wrestled with the Spirit. Both were debilitated by the Spirit. The Spirit of Satan nearly killed both men, wrestling with him. Both men admit that they were demon-possessed. Paul did not have a revelation from Jesus Christ, and most certainly not from the Messiah Yahusha. The spirit that he met along the road to Damascus was Satan. It's obvious. He admits it. Yahusha makes it absolutely, unequivocally clear. And the fact is that the words that he puts in Satan's mouth, that Satan spoke to him, were the words of Dionysus, the Greek mythological son of God that formed the basis of the caricature known in Christianity as Jesus Christ. Beyond that, Paul was taught. Paul learned by his own admission to be a rabbi. Claimed to be the best rabbinical student, claimed to be a better student than anybody else, claimed to have been taught rabbinic Judaism by the best of the rabbinic scholars. So he's lying here. He was taught. And he's lying. He did not meet with the Messiah Yahusha. He knows it. Yahusha makes it extraordinarily clear in his Olivet discourse, as he is preparing his disciples for his fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Makorim. He tells them emphatically that there will be those who will come, who will deceive even the elect, those who were chosen by him, who will deceive even those who were chosen by him, that he has seen him in the wilderness. And he says, but don't believe him. He's lying. The only person who made this claim, the only one, is Paul. And why is it that not one Christian in a million can put those two facts together? That Yahusha warned his disciples specifically about Paul and his claim to have met with him on the road to Damascus. saying if he, when he comes and makes that claim, don't follow him. Don't believe him. He is lying. So either Yahusha was a complete liar and should not be trusted, or Paul is lying. And if Yahusha is lying, then Paul's irrelevant. And if Yahusha was telling the truth, then Paul is the plague of death. The most disastrous man who ever lived. The most conniving, conspiring, duplicitous, deadly persona in all of human history. Those are the only two rational choices. And right in the context of this, he doesn't lie just once, but twice. He said he was not taught when, in fact, he will brag about being taught. And he says that he met with the Messiah Yahusha when he, in fact, met with Satan and knows it. That's why he admits to being demon-possessed. Contradicting his previous statement, while at the same time contravening Yahweh's and Yahusha's approach to teaching, Paul would have us believe that he did not associate with men and that he was not taught. He is evidently not ready to disclose the fact that he had been in rabbinic school for many years. According to Paul, his message had been previously undisclosed and that he alone had the right to convey what was miraculously unveiled, appearing to him in a revelation attested by no one. So it brings and begs the question, if this is so, why did Yahweh bother with his Torah? Why did Yahusha bother with the disciples?